chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
This is D.G. Martin. Our Chapelboro neighbor, Barbara Bennett, teaches at North Carolina State. She not only teaches, she writes about some of our favorite authors. She's the expert on Jill McCorkle, for instance. So the question is, how did she get hooked on the caring for African animals, or I guess for animals of all varieties, for lions and monkeys? And how did all that lead to the publication of her book, Soul of a Lion, published by National Geographic? All of those are the questions that I sort of wanted to start with when I persuaded Barbara Bennett to come join me. Professor Barbara Bennett, welcome.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
All right. What's the answer to the question? How does a popular a professor of English and literature at North Carolina State get hooked on animal, on the care of animals?
Well, I've always just been a big animal lover. I think if I had another life to live, I might go into animal behavior or animal care. But I ended up in English. And when I was getting ready to take a sabbatical to write an academic book on environmentalism and literature, I decided that I didn't want to just talk the talk. I wanted to walk the walk as well. And so I started searching for some volunteer experiences. And when I saw this internet program to be a volunteer to go to Africa and work with orphaned, injured, and abandoned wild animals, I just knew it
that
was,
cut your heart. Well, that's kind of like, I mean, that's a little girl sort of thing, isn't it? You
absolutely
want to take care of the baby squirrel whose mama's been run over.
Exactly.
And you want to bring him into the house, and it's an urge that we have to care for, and you think of it, especially, I mean, all of us that way, but I mean, you type it with little girls, or they're just suckers for taking care of animals.
I went through that horse period and the dog period and reading all the books I could get my hands on. So, yeah, I was well prepared for falling in love with this place, which I did almost immediately.
Well, tell us about I'm curious about the experience of choosing to do this. And so you're surrounded, as Chapel Hill people are and as faculty members at Duke or State or Chapel Hill are, by academics who are interested in academic advancement and in producing teaching, service, and publication. And it's kind of a special community. And so in the midst of that community, this is quite a decision to spend your sabbatical. Now, tell us how.
True.
Tell us about, or maybe it wasn't. Maybe you just said, this is what I want to do. It's my sabbatical. I'll do what I want to. The heck with everybody else.
Well, it was a little like that. But I just wanted to do something far away, get away from Chapel Hill, where my students couldn't contact me every day while I was on sabbatical. And I started to find there's wonderful volunteer activities out there. I first thought about working with elephants in Sri Lanka, and there were some ones in Madagascar that sounded fabulous, but they were mostly working with one specific animal, and I was drawn to this one because it's such a variety of animals.
Well, for people like me, for instance, who might have time and who might this might be an appeal, what were some of the options, that both in terms of time commitment, cost, and the opportunities for either high-level service or just low-level cleaning up after the animals. So, what were the options that you found as you looked for something to do in terms of working with animals?
Well, Ed, there's a whole new kind of volunteering that's called volunteerism, tourism versus volunteering, the combination of the two. And there are groups that will set up these wonderful experiences for you. But it is like sort of a vacation because you pay for it. You know, the money that I paid goes to help feed the animals and take care of them. So it's not like a lot of volunteer experiences where you work for free and they don't ask for any money in return. I wanted to do something to actually help the animals with more than just my time.
And so Barbara Bennett, it just, I'll be selfish. I want to spend, if I should be someone who said, hey, that might be fun to go to Africa and
it
not just
fun.
Tour around and hunt animals or go on the photo, but to really be in one place and be involved in a project.
Right.
Now, can you do that for a week? Can you do it for 2 weeks? You got to do it for a year? What is
– Well, most of these groups ask for you to spend at least 2 weeks. Now, at Harness, where I went, you can go for 2 weeks or up to 3 months. So you have your choice. You pay per week. I think it came out to be around $700 a week for me. Plus, you have to pay for your airfare back and forth. And I went for 2 weeks the first time, but it was truly not enough time. I cried all the way home because I had to leave already. But most groups let you stay as short a time as 2 weeks, and then some of them let you stay as long as you want.
Well, tell us now about Harness. This is the place where you worked and is the where you had the experience that is the basis for your book, Soul of a Lion. So tell us, introduce us. You can't tell us all about it, but tell us a little bit about tell us how you found it on your – as you – Well, tell us about the airplane ride over and tell us about that first day.
Well, you know, to prepare for this trip, I really didn't know what I was doing because they send you a list of things to make sure you bring and you you sort of imagine what it'd be like. I'd never been to Africa before. And but I admit I was a little nervous just to by myself. Get
You're
on
all
a plane.
By yourself?
Went by myself and just get on a plane and fly almost 22, 23 hours to get to Africa.
All right. Now, how do you get to Africa?
South African Air has a direct flight from New York to Johannesburg, South Africa. Okay. And then it's just a short trip on either side of that to get to New York and to get to Windhoek, which is the name of the Namibian capital.
Most people probably won't know where would assume that you're talking about going to South Africa, but you weren't going to South Africa at all.
No, I went to Namibia, which used to be part of South Africa. It was called Southwest Africa or West South Africa. And but in 1990, it separated and became its own country. So it's very stable. It's very safe. They have a good government.
And it's my memory of this region of Southwest Africa was originally a German colony, I guess.
German and Dutch. And the British were there for a while. Too. The best schools in Namibia are all German, so it still has a very strong German influence.
And what is it? What is Namibia like in terms? Is it jungles? Is it desert? Is it what's
well,
it?
Well, it's
it?
Quite diverse, but the part where I went to was right on the edge of the Kalahari Desert, so that was very dry and desert-like. But there are also lush parts in the northwestern, and there's a wonderful seacoast that's just beautiful. They have a resort town called Swakopmund, which is like a little Dutch village right on the ocean, and great fish and, you know, marine activities, boating, and there are lots of animals in the water there. So,
all right, so you got on the airplane, got to Cape Town, got on another airplane to take you in from South Africa to the adjoining country of Namibia.
And arrived at this airport and had no idea if there would be anybody waiting for me or if I was just going to have to wander around. And Harness is about 3.5 hours from the airport, so I needed a transport. And they said they'd be waiting, but I really didn't know if I would get off the plane and find anybody. But there was a bushman standing there with a sign that had my last name on it. So I was relieved and excited that
a bushman.
The native people in Namibia and in a good part of Africa are bushmen. And Marita, who is the woman who runs Harness, has employed a lot of local people to help her and has helped the local economy and the local people that way.
These are tribal people through, and they're throughout Africa, or they are just in the southern part?
They're mostly in the southern part, but they're spread out all the way across from east to west.
And are they distinct from other Africans?
Very much so. They are lighter skinned than most black Africans. They are smaller, more petite. The women sometimes are only about 4 foot 8, 4 foot 9. Mm-hmm. They have their own language. It's that language that you've probably heard with the clicking and clacking. Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah. They have their own culture. They were hunters and nomads. They would travel from place to place. But that's gotten very difficult for them now because they in a way, they're like our American Indians here in this country because they've had their land just taken from them. And
they were roamers and hunters and
exactly.
gatherers. And then as the Western type.
The explorers and the black African tribes started, you know, moving into their territory as well. So they've been forced into their version of reservations. And
so you're met at the airplane by Bushman.
He's in normal clothes.
He's got the same kind of haircut.
Generally short hair.
Can he speak English?
With an accent. But he was. He was very nice and carried my bags, even though I was much bigger than he was and should have carried my own bags. Very polite and took me to pick up some other volunteers.
So you get in a truck or in a...
In a big Jeep van. And kind of van-like.
So there were other... He didn't come just to get you.
He came to get me, but others had come before me and were waiting in a backpacker's lodge. So we went to pick up them and then just... headed out into the bush, 3.5 hours riding
the bush,
in this
meaning
Jeep.
The jungle is the what is the
well,
bush?
The bush is a sort of a desert landscape with low bushes and some big African trees and so on, but it's very dry. So
like
the dirt roads,
Great Plains of America.
Well, sort of like the Southwest, I guess, without the saguaro cactuses. It looks a lot like the Southwest.
So you're tired. You're riding in there.
I've been on the plane for 25 hours.
Are you just crouched there going to sleep, or are you making friends with the bushman and the other people in the car?
I made friends with the other volunteers. There were 7 of us that arrived for this trip, and I was the oldest by far.
Really?
Yeah, most of the volunteers are between maybe 18 and 25. A lot of European kids who are taking their gap year. You know, that they take a year off either during school or after they finish school before they get their first job. They take a year, and it's a wonderful experience. I think so many more American kids should do stuff like that. They travel and just get to know the world and try to figure out what it is they want to do with their lives.
Well, we got to take a break, but I'm visiting with Barbara Bennett, who's the author of a new book, Soul of the Lion, and it's One Woman's Quest to Rescue Africa's Wildlife Refugees, and we're going to talk more about her experience after this short break.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Professor Barbara Bennett from North Carolina State University. No, she teaches at North Carolina State University. She's from Chapel Hill, or Chapelboro, as we say. And we're talking about her book, Soul of a Lion, her experience on the Hamas wildlife. Did they say preserve? What do they call this? A sanctuary where they rescue and rehabilitate wild animals who, for one reason or another, are not presently equipped to return into the wild. And we got you on the road from the airport at Windhoek, which is in Namibia near South Africa, and you're driving out into this bush, which you say looks like the American Southwest, sort of.
Yeah, a lot like the Southwest.
And what are the roads like?
Well, it's paved part of the way, about half the way. And then after we reach a small town called Hobabis, they picked up a lot of supplies because the sanctuary is always needing supplies and the closest town is an hour and a half away. So we picked up a lot of supplies and then we headed out on dirt roads just out into the middle of nowhere. And by then it had gotten dark, and when I arrived, they just assigned us our rooms and our beds, and I had been on the road for 30 some hours by now, And I just collapsed in bed. So I didn't get a look around. I didn't even know kind of where I was.
So you didn't have any sense of all these animals who might be and people caring
for
you.
Yeah, I didn't know how close they were. But I, as I fell asleep, I heard this sort of screaming, and I couldn't it was sort of like a person, but it was more like a child screaming. I found out later it was the baboons that were just, you know, 15 yards from my window, and they were having their nighttime fun play, and they were all screaming at each other, and I didn't realize, but I fell asleep wondering, what kind of creature is this? It sounds like it's my neighbor.
But he's not going to keep me awake tonight.
No, he didn't.
Well, that's exciting. Sorry. So you then you eventually you do wake up, and you.
I woke up and I just decided to go a little exploring before they told me what time breakfast was, and I went out on this lawn that was outside my room, and there were ostriches strolling around and baby springboks, and there was a giraffe and warthogs all moving around together, and then a couple of volunteers walked by holding baby baboons that were wrapped up in diapers, and I just stood there and thought, I'm dreaming. This is a wonderland, and I mean, it's every little girl's dream to find herself surrounded by exotic animals. And I just knew right then that I was in love with this place.
What did after breakfast, what did you find out that you were going to be doing?
Well, volunteers are assigned to specific groups, four groups, that you feed and clean the enclosures and care for. And so most of the morning is spent doing that. And then in the afternoon, sometimes you do farm work like fixing fences or cleaning water holes and things like that. But every spare minute, the people there encourage you to bond with the animals, which was a very easy chore to be given. And so I would spend my afternoons sitting in with the meerkats and letting them run all over me and fall asleep on my lap, or brushing burrs out of the coats of cheetahs, or taking the baby lions on walks. And
amazing. When did you meet this inspirational woman who's organized this sanctuary?
Well, I didn't meet Marita for a couple of days, but one day I came to the lawn area, which is called the Lapa area, and there was a woman sitting on the grass with about five baby baboons playing around and jumping on her, grabbing her hair, and I just sat down quietly and hoped to meet her, and got to have a conversation with her. And she's, we've heard of the dog whisperer and the horse whisperer, but I mean, she's just the animal whisperer. There's not a species, I don't think, that she can't relate to and communicate with. It's truly a fascinating woman.
How did she get this sanctuary? What is her background, and how did she get the sanctuary started?
Well, she is a native Namibian. She's white, but she's one of the Dutch settlers, or descendant of Dutch settlers. And when she was married early in her life, about age 20, she and her husband had this cattle farm. But she started rescuing animals that she found, pets that had been abandoned, or ones that had been hit by cars, or hunters had trapped and didn't know what to do with. And she just started collecting animals one by one until eventually, after a number of years, they sold their cattle and created the sanctuary. So it wasn't a plan. It wasn't a lifelong goal. It just sort of happened. And she was born for it. I mean, she just—it was the perfect thing for her to do.
And so, is it supported by donations or by the payments that the volunteers would make, or
the volunteer money and donations? They get no government funds or anything like that. So it's a foundation now. So the family money is protected, because they almost went bankrupt caring for the animals. And they used to be one of the wealthiest families in Namibia, but they spent it all on animals. So they created a foundation to help.
How do you organize a wildlife sanctuary out there, I guess you say, in the bush?
Yeah.
Where you've got a whole bunch of different animals to different degrees, I guess, accommodating to the human environment, and all of them basically wild, I guess.
Right.
So do you keep them separate? Do you have to build fences to keep them in?
Well, it's interesting, DG. One of the things that I've learned is that baby animals don't have a lot of their instincts about aggression toward other species. And so at any one time in Marita's house, she could have a baby leopard that will be curled up with a puppy or kitten or a meerkat. They all seem to get along when they're babies. It's truly amazing that, you'll see a baby baboon sleeping with a lion cub. Because they need to be nurtured when they're babies, they need to be close to people. So the volunteers and Marita, spend a lot, all these hours with the babies. And then as the babies grow older, they're moved to enclosures that are still close to the main area, but they are separated within the species. And then when they become grown and they develop their natural instincts, then she moves them farther out from the main place into enclosures with their own kind, and the only contact they have with people is feeding.
So most of them are going to be confined for their rest of their lives. They're just not going to be able to get back into the wild.
Well, unfortunately, because some of these were raised as pets or they've been injured. There's some three-legged wild dogs but animals that are caught in traps and have to have their leg amputated, things like that. A lot of those animals can't be released, but about 25% can be released. And so she has deals with the Bushmen for their territory to release cheetahs, for example, on their land. And she also has about 10,000 acres that she calls her lifeline refuge, where she has created sort of a miniature Africa where animals are released and it's in a natural environment and they do their own hunting and they, graze. And so she's...
She can kind of keep watch over them, but they're on their own pretty much.
Right. And both the big carnivores have radio collars so they can keep track of them and things like that. So it's an interesting organization, and it's evolved over time. It's not something that she sat down and planned out from day one.
We're visiting with Barbara Bennett, our Chapel Borough neighbor, who is a professor of English and literature at North Carolina State University, talking about her book, Soul of a Lion, and she and I will be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with DG Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is DG Martin. I'm visiting with Barbara Bennett about her experience working on a wildlife sanctuary in Namibia.
Namibia.
Namibia. Mm-hmm. Namibia. I can better say Southwest Africa, which is what it used to be. And it's called the Harness Wildlife Sanctuary. We've talked about your experience, but we ought to talk a little bit about your book. And you've agreed to read just a small portion that might give us a little bit of the flavor of the book.
Well, I'd be happy to. I mean, most of the book tells the story of Marita Vandermeer, who started the sanctuary. But in the introduction, I tell some of my own experiences about being a volunteer there. And so I have a short piece that is probably the most meaningful to me. So I'll get right that. It's at the end of the introduction. I have more personal stories to tell, but this book isn't really about me. It's about Marita and Harness, and I have plenty of amazing and entertaining stories collected there. But perhaps you'll permit me one last personal story, the one that means the most to me, the one that changed how I feel about the rest of my life. One night near the end of my second visit, I slept out in one of the cheetah enclosures by myself with two female cheetahs, Cleopatra and Pride. These two beauties were kittens during my first visit, and I had fed them, petted them, brushed them, and planted kisses on their sweet faces. Volunteers sleep out with animals sometimes, usually in pairs or groups, but I never had, so it was a significant night for me. Originally, one of the women from the office was going to go with me, but she backed out at the last minute. I'd been planning on it for days, though, so I went alone. I dragged a foam mattress out to the cheetah's enclosure, laid my sleeping bag on it, and went to find the cats to alert them to my presence. No surprises, please. Then I snuggled down into my bag. About 15 minutes later, pride glided over. I heard her purr long before I saw those amber eyes emerge out of the African night. Cheetahs have the loudest purr of all cats, and pride's is especially strong. She strolled over to me, put one paw on each side of my face, tickled my cheek with her tongue, and plopped down with her neck stretched across mine. Then she really let that purr roll forth. I felt as if I were inside one of those vibrating beds that take quarters in motel rooms. I wrapped my arms around her in a furry embrace, and in a few minutes, we both fell asleep. After an hour, she stood up, stretched, and wandered away. Sometime later, she came back. Then Cleo joined us, stretching her body across my legs and resting her head on my lap. The three of us spent the rest of the night like a litter of kittens, all tangled up together. It was a cold night, but I had almost 300 pounds of cheetah keeping me warm. Burying my nose in Pride's neck, my hands around her chest, I stayed toasty. Once I woke up to find that I had been displaced and was sleeping on hard ground, my mattress occupied by both cats. Cleo was splayed on her back with paws in the air and white belly exposed trustingly. I scrambled up as best I could in my sleeping bag and scooched back over, pushing my way in between the cheetahs to reclaim my spot on the mattress. Later during the night, I awoke and looked up at the moon and the unfamiliar stars in the African sky. I had a cheetah's head buried in my neck, another purring in my lap, and I thought, if nothing good ever happens to me again, it's all right. I've had this, and this is worth more than anyone deserves. The sun came up about 5:30. We snuggled some more, and they groomed each other and me, licking my face and arms till they were raw. At 7 o'clock, I said my goodbyes and went home to a hot shower, forever changed.
Well, I mean, that raises all kinds of questions. First of all, I mean, about the emotional experience that you had. I mean, we have these times that we'll remember forever.
Right.
But the idea, these are wild animals. I mean, these are wild animals whose instincts by this time are developing. And isn't it risky? I mean, these are not animals that you can count on to be tame forever.
That's right. And I had spent a lot of hours with these two cheetahs before I slept with them because I wanted them to know me and feel comfortable with me. And the great thing about cheetahs is that they are really very shy, quiet creatures that would prefer avoiding people rather than being aggressive toward them. So this is easy to do with cheetahs. It would not be something you could do with lions that are of a certain age, and certainly not with leopards.
So cheetahs are different.
Cheetahs are very different, and they're much less aggressive. Even when they become grown and sexually mature, they tend to remain very gentle. And it's one of the reasons they're just my favorite big cat. They just they're just fabulous.
Well, as the cheetahs get more mature, these are sort of in not quite fully mature cheetahs.
Right.
Could you go back and do this again next year?
Well, unfortunately, Cleo passed away. One of the reasons she was with them in the sanctuary is that she had a brain aneurysm and had some trouble walking and things. And she did have an aneurysm and die. But Pride is, she's the pride of the sanctuary right now because she has been moved out to the Lifeline Project, radio collared, and she does her own hunting now and is just living the wild life of a cheetah. And yet, you can go out there, and when they track her with the radio collar, she will still come over and nuzzle you and give you kisses on the face. So she's, you know, living the wild life of a cheetah, but she still loves her human companions.
Well, this flies in the face of what our common wisdom is about the corruption of the wild instincts of wild animals in their contact with humans, that it just, they can't do both, is what
right.
Our common idea is. And this sort of proves that, at least in this case, with Pride, the cheetah's case, doesn't work that way.
It's true. And they've used her story as a case study to prove that you can rehabilitate an animal that has been raised by hand, you know, from a baby. And she is an amazing story. And people have been very interested in what they've been able to accomplish with her.
Well, the other thing about about this kind of experience of taking an animal who's raised essentially by humans, then placing that animal out in the in the nature preserve so that the animal's on his or her own hunting and out there in competition with other animals, I guess there is some risk that the other animals will figure out a way to make her prey.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things that I've learned through this experience is that, first of all, big cats can't be vegetarians. It's been really hard for me to accept that, but you just can't make a lion or a cheetah a vegetarian. And so, you know, I have to accept the fact that they're going to be hunting springboks and warthogs and bring them down and eat them. And, you know, and I have to accept the fact that there is risk for this cheetah out there. Poachers could get in, although they have good fences. And fortunately, there are no lions in the lifeline right now, but they are considering putting them out there. And that would be a risk to her. But that's life in the wild, and it's been very difficult for me because I just want to protect them all and make them all my babies and take them home and tuck them into bed. But I've had to understand this cycle of the way nature works.
One of the things that would be difficult for certainly for me, I guess it must be for you, is that these animals, not all of them are like the cheetahs, and that animals that you might have cuddled with when they were young could kill you now.
That's true. It is, especially with the lions. It's very difficult for me because when they're young, they're just so wonderful. And then when the males get big enough that they start getting their manes, you know, they just turn very aggressive. And it breaks your heart.
Yeah.
It really does break your heart to walk by their enclosure and have them growl at me. It just it hurts. But it's also the way it's got to be. It's got to be.
We're visiting with Barbara Bennett about her book, Soul of a Lion, One Woman's Quest to Rescue Africa's Wildlife Refugees. She and I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're visiting with our neighbor, but North Carolina State Professor Barbara Bennett, about her book, Soul of a Lion, published by National Geographic. That's got to be a feather in your cap.
Oh, it was fabulous. I have an agent in New York who tried to sell the book, and I just can't imagine a better publisher for this kind of work than National Geographic. I was thrilled, and they were so good to me. It was really
well, that's
wonderful.
Another story, and I'd like to visit with you about that sometime as well. The subtitle of your book is One Woman's Quest to Rescue Africa's Wildlife Refugees, and you mentioned Marita a little bit before. Tell us, but the story centers around her work and her family and her sanctuary. Tell us some more about Marita.
Well, she's an animal person. I would never call her a people person.
She's not a people person?
No, she has actually very little patience for people in there.
She whispers to animals, but not to people.
I know. And that's sometimes hard for people to take. But she just would prefer to be sitting with a group of lions than to be with a group of people that she has to socialize with. So she's...
Well, how'd you get her to tell her story?
Oh, well, that's actually very interesting because I tried for a couple of weeks to get her to sit across the table with me and interview, and it just wasn't working. People would come in and need her, that she's constantly needed. And so finally, her daughter-in-law suggested that we go for walks. And so one of her daughters-in-law would go with me and Marita in the evening. As the sun was setting, and we would go walk by the lion's enclosure, and then we could sort of prompt her, oh, tell us the story of this lion. You know, how did this lion end up at the sanctuary? And then she didn't, for one thing, she didn't have to be looking right at me, which was good. And I had this little tape recorder that I surreptitiously hooked to my collar so she couldn't, didn't feel like she had a microphone in her face. And I would record everything she said. And so we did this for weeks. Every night we'd go walking, and I got a lot of great stories from her that way because she could just, you know, it was more like visiting than an interview, but it was difficult. She's not a talker.
Right. So you mentioned earlier, excuse me for jumping around, but you mentioned mm-hmm. earlier that you go on first for 2 weeks and then sad to leave and and quickly arranged to come back. And how long did you stay the second time?
The second and third times I stayed a month each and to do the interviews. So it worked out really well to be there for a month in June and then go home and work on the book. And then I knew what other stories I needed to hear. So I went back in December for another month to get more stories. And besides, it was an excuse to go back.
You mentioned that Marita, although she lives in Namibia, if I say mm-hmm. I'm trying to say that right, Namibia, which is largely a black country, but mm-hmm. has a white history as well. But you introduced us to some of the complicated relationships among the black African people mm-hmm. in Namibia, particularly the relationships with the Bush people, who
right.
kind of tend to be on the lower strata.
They are.
It's more complicated than any of us could imagine. Can you summarize what you found to be the people story in that part of Africa?
Well, the people, it is complicated. The class system there, and even though it's post-apartheid, there is this still very strong racism within the country, which was, you know, hard for me to take, but at the same time, we have a lot of the same problems in this country, so I completely understood. But the one
Let
thing—
Let me just settle on that for a moment. The country is run in by a democracy, and so the—
And their president is a black man.
The black majority are the rulers, but the economically, the whites still remain in economic control.
By far, because most of the land is owned by white people still. So the black people have who work a lot for the whites, but they have an interesting law that if a white person wants to sell land, the government buys it from them and then gives it to a black person to own. And they have so many years to get it into a working, profit-making place. And so little by little, they're trying to share the wealth.
It's a gradual land redistribution program.
Very gradual,
revolutionary
yes.
type.
Right.
What about the black Africans' social divisions? And particularly, I got interested as you described the challenges that the Bush men face.
Right, because I mean, the Bush people are definitely at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder, and they struggle and have been exploited by both the whites and the blacks. And they have very high alcoholism rate, very high AIDS rate, low literacy. It's a real problem. But the thing that I really appreciate about Marita is that she has hired she hires local people, both black and Bushmen, and she understands that you can't just save the wildlife of Africa. You have to make saving them meaningful to the people there. And so she's set up a clinic for the black people and the Bushmen. She has a school for the Bushmen children so that they can be ready. It's a preschool, so that by the time they're ready to go to school, they're more prepared than they used to be. So she's taken an interest in the community as well as the animals because she understands that they're all connected.
Well, give us the in your elevator speech what this book meant to you and what you'd like for it to mean to your readers?
Well, I think people would enjoy the story because it is about a strong woman. Basically, it's about a strong woman who changes the world. But I include a lot of fascinating animal stories that I just, you know, loved hearing and loved writing about. And some of them are funny. Some of them are tragic. Some of them are just entertaining. But I think anybody who loves animals would love to hear these stories like I did, because they're just they hit you in the heart pretty hard. And I think it's a positive. I tried to make it a very positive, uplifting book.
Well, I think you've done a good job, and we thank you for sharing a little bit of that book and your experience with us. Our guest has been Barbara Bennett. She's the author of Soul of the Lion. Thanks to her, and thanks
thank
to you.
You.
Thanks to everybody for joining us. This has been Who's Talking? D.G. Martin, and I'll be right back here before you know it.